interesting little mathematical expressions. But when we stopped Friday, I know it's hard to remember Friday, but we had convinced ourselves that if I represented a number here in the computer, it was probably going to be the number I desired to. So this was the computer representation. Sometimes I may write this simply as FL of x for the floating point representation of x. Then it's the, let's say desired number. And then 1 plus, multiplied by 1 plus some error that we committed here. So this here would be error. And of course, here when I write it, then it's the relative error. And we also said that for practical purposes here, then we can say that delta, when we do these manipulation, it's what we talked about as machine epsilon. And so there's a number of things here that I want to say. So I have and they're not very insightful or deep because I came up with them myself. But so this is the first one here. If you at all can, then try to use integers if you can, right? And this sounds like, because as I hope that I convinced you, if we can use integers, then we can actually manipulate them without these roundup errors, okay? So here there's no round off. You'll be surprised when you start looking at codes when people, for instance, they manipulate integers, but then all those integers might be represent or multiplied by h bar, for instance, and then they go in and represent everything as floats. Because conceptually, that's how you want to think about them. If you turn the things upside down and say, I want to work with integers, when is the absolute last time that I have to convert something to floating point real precision? In quite a few occasions, you'll realize that that's maybe at the point where you're just printing the final result on the screen. And this can make a huge difference. Okay, now we're at the point where we realize that this cannot be done and we have to work with what we have here. So I want to do some simple remarks here. Let's look at a subtractive error here. So I want to Okay, I want to calculate A equal to B minus C. So if I do this, then on the computer, I'm going to have to do this. So actually, what I'll be calculating is AC, which is equal to BC minus CC. Okay. Now, if I just substitute in what we did over here, then this would be B, and then 1 plus delta B here, and then minus C, and 1 plus delta C. Okay, so then when I now look at the relative error here, I want to divide through with A here, then it's 1 plus delta B here, and then minus C over A, 1 plus delta C here. So if we write out what this here is, then I get B minus C over A. This is our desired result. And then I get plus B over A delta B, and then minus C over A delta C. So if we assume that we're doing something that's dangerous. In other words, here, if B is very close to C, so for practical purposes, I can assume that they're the same here, then AC over A here, this here is just 1. Then I get a plus B over A here, and then delta B minus delta C. So the conclusion here is that if B tends to C, then A here will go to 0, and this will diverge. You could, of course, try to cook up some kind of argument that the error here should cancel, but really you have no control over that. And in any case, if you take these close enough, then this here is always going to cause you a problem. Obvious conclusion when you try to do something like this is that we can write another programming hint over here. And that's simply that we shouldn't take, we shouldn't subtract two large floating point numbers to get a small one. And in quite a few occasions, the results of doing that can be really disastrous. So a corollary to that one is if we look at the another case that we've sort of, if I look at the case where I'm adding these numbers, then I can make another point here that you'll actually, for the tutorial this afternoon, you'll be playing around with that. If I turn this one around here and say I should avoid adding small number to a very large number. So you may lose all the information here, because if what you're trying to do is to take an order of number 1, of order 1 here, and then add something that's very small to it, then when that small number gets smaller than machine epsilon, then per definition, we're just going to get 1. And if you do that many, many times, then that could lead to rather incorrect results. So we have to be a little bit careful. The other thing here is, of course, that I can look at multiplications. And so let's just look at multiplications. So I want to calculate A here, which is equal to B times C. And on the computer here, what I end up doing is setting AC equal to BC and then times CC. And that's, of course, equal to B and then 1 plus delta B and then C 1 plus delta C. So if I look at AC here over A, then this is BC over A and then 1 plus delta B here and then 1 plus delta C. And we assume here that this is just going to be 1. So roughly, this here is 1 plus delta B and then plus delta C. So when we are multiplying these numbers together, then I'm actually just summing up the round-off error. And you can say, well, if there's some kind of so let's think a little bit about this and make some estimates. So let me make some ballpark estimates here. We assume that all the round-off errors are equal to a constant that we're just going to call delta. And then I perform n multiplications. What I can see from this here is that the maximum compound error, if I'm just incredibly unlucky, it could actually go all the way up to n times delta. If I look at a typical error, how would you guess at a typical error here? If I'm adding deltas together here, but I'm assuming that some of them could be minus delta and some of them could be plus delta, how would that sum work out? What?
Root of delta 1 squared plus delta 1 squared.
Sort of ballpark way of thinking about this is that I'm just performing a random walk around zero. Right, so if the step size is always delta, then I may be going a couple of steps in that direction and then a couple of steps back. And then I wait after a huge number of steps, and then I'm looking at where might I expect to be, how far at that point might I expect to be away from the zero, and you would say, well, maybe a typical error, a more typical one, would be a root n. This here, when I do this, this is called a floating point operation. And it's not a particularly good measure, but one talks about flops here. So that's a floating point operation per second, what do you think your typical laptop, how many of these can it do per second? That's a pretty good, it's a pretty good estimate. It's of that order, so we can assume here, maybe instead of a billion, let's say that roughly today you could typically have 10 to the 10 of these flops per second. Okay, so now I run my computer here doing nothing but that for 10 hours. So, for 10 hours. And that would mean that I can do something, if you just count the seconds here, that would be 3.6 and then 10 to the 14 flops. So if you start your computer the first thing in the morning, then depending on when you get up, but say you start at 8 in the morning, then at 6 at night, you can see that you might have performed 10 to the 14th of these multiplications if it's not doing anything else. If we go over here and then remember that delta for a 32-bit reel here, that's maybe something like 10 to the minus 7. If we have a 64-bit reel, the double precision, then it was maybe 10 to the minus 16. But you can see that if I do something like this, even just a typical error here, if I'm running in 32-bit reels and I have a delta here, which is 10 to the minus 7, then this here could be a problem if delta is of the order of 10 to the minus 7. Right, then you would, even in this case, you've gotten an error, which is basically the order 1. now, typically, it actually doesn't go that bad, but you can be highly suspicious of making this work. So let's look at so what you want to do here is you should try to avoid these horrible accumulation of errors. So let's look at a few examples here and see how you can improve things. So let's do the first example here. So we want to calculate the square root of x squared plus 1 minus 1. Is there a problem in calculating this? Or rather, when is there a problem? Well, if you look at this, you can see that this here is problematic for small x, right? Because if x here is very small, x squared might be even smaller, and this would mean that I'm subtracting two numbers which are almost the same, and then I'm hoping to get a very small number. So this was precisely one of the cases that we should try to avoid. Yeah?
You So here should you like change it to a real of like a above floating?
Yeah. So you're definitely right. It happened that my x here, I could have foreseen that it was, well, in this case, once I've taken the square root, then I'm pretty much done. I can't.
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by what was the issue. Like, I added here. Would you, like?
In this case, I would, I'm assuming that you can't. What I meant by that you should try to always use integers is that quite often the calculation that you're trying to do is inherently actually based on manipulating integer variables. And it's only at the very end that you're multiplying by an overall coupling constant or other things. For instance, if you remember the course that Leo Kanovov did, then he would talk about the ESA model. The ESA model is defined in terms of integer variables, and it's only when you convert it to thermodynamic quantities that you get something that's in real floating point variables. So typical calculations with the ESA model, you can actually, for a large part, reduce them to manipulating integers. This here is sort of a typical calculation for some mathematical expression that you would have, and in this case, you likely cannot go that way. I told you this first program hints just because I know in many cases where you actually just take integers, multiply them by 0.3, and then do the whole calculation with a major loss in precision. So let's assume that that's not possible here. What should you do here then?
Well, so what you want to do here is we want to rewrite this expression. So how can I rewrite this so there is no subtractive error? Takes a little bit of, it looks like you, right? You know, you know mathematics, so we multiply by one. One, I'm going to write it as the square root of x squared plus 1, plus 1 over the square root of x squared plus 1, plus 1. Right? So if I do this, then I get x squared plus 1, and then minus 1 over the square root of x squared plus 1, plus 1. So this here is a, oh, sorry. This here is a mathematical equivalent expression. And of course, the ones cancel. So I claim that the expression that I had here, which would have been, had suffered a major subtractive error if when x is very small, I can just simply rewrite it, right? So bad expression, good expression. And so let me do my favorite. So it's sort of an analog to this one, which I know of nobody who is not at some point going to actually implement. So let's do another example here. So let's look at example 2 here. And that example is that I'm trying to solve a well-known equation. Does that look familiar? So if b squared here, it's a lot larger than 4AC, then I'm actually taking B or I'm taking B and then subbing or adding B to it. So B squared minus 4AC here, if I take the square root of that, then that's quite close to B. And so that means that in certain limits for this second order equation, evaluating or finding the root using this formula here is actually going to lose quite a bit of precision. So the way to actually do this is I get one root. So if I look at it here, it's only depending on the sign of B here, it's only going to be one of the roots here that will give us a problem. So I have this subtractive error for one root. But I can calculate the good root here that doesn't have a round-off error if I'm a little bit careful. So we have to figure out what the what we should do here. So the one I want to calculate here is minus, and then B, and then plus the sine of B here, multiplied here by B squared minus 4AC. Okay? And divide this by 2A. Now, if B is negative, then both these terms will be negative, both B and the sign here, B. So roughly, I'm going to get minus 2B inside the parentheses. If B is positive, then both of them are going to give me roughly B. So in this case, when I rewrite this expression here, I have eliminated the subtractive error, and I can calculate x1 this way. How do we get the other root? If I know one root of a second order equation, how do I get the second one?
I give up and go home. This I learned in high school, so you should...
How are the roots related in a second order equation? Nobody want to. You do.
Field theory, but you don't know how the root of an equation, a second order equation, is related. So if you go back and look it up, right, then the product here. You can just, well, if we do x minus x1 and x minus x2 here,
I claim that this should be ax squared plus bx plus c, right? Then you can see that in doing that, then the constant c here, It's actually just going to be the product of the two. So what I'm claiming here is that C has to be x1, x2 times A, right? And so if I do this, then I can simply immediately get x2 here, which is, by the way, way faster than actually going through and doing the divisions. I just get it as, well, let's see here. It would be C over A multiplied by X1. Okay, so I can solve this equation, and then I can get x2. So typically, if you're clever about finding the roots of a second-order equation, then let me do yet another example. So what I'm trying to get at here is that just because you're writing a program, that's not an excuse for not thinking, right? Because detecting that you might have a subtractive error here is not very difficult. And once you get going with this little game, in many, many occasions, you can actually find ways of rewriting the equations that you have, and you may get significantly better expressions. So this was, let's do an example three here. So I have 1 minus cosine of x here divided by x squared. And so if anybody is quick on their hands, they might actually check this while I'm telling you this. So I want to set x here equal to 1.2 × 10⁻⁵. And that's, of course, very bad, because it would mean that cosine of x here is very close to 0. So I would get almost 1, and the numerator would suffer probably a horrible cancellation. So to 10 significant digits, if I do 1 minus cosine of x here, it's simply 0.9999999999, and then 9 and 9. Okay. So, this is just cosine of x. And then 1 minus cosine of x here, well, it would have to be 0.00000000001. Okay. So if I then look at 1 minus cosine of x over x squared, then this is 10 to the minus 10 here. And then over this one squared, so that's 1.44 and 10 to the minus 10. And if you work this out, then this here's 0.6944. Okay, so however, it's very easy to see that the expression that I wrote here, it's actually always going to be less than a half. So you can see that you actually accumulated an error here, which is up at the lead-in digit, even though you might think that 1.2 × 10⁻⁵ here, it sounds like that's not very much. So you can try this on your computer and see what result you get simply by evaluating this expression here with that value of x. So let me make a comment that before we look at how we would solve this here, So your computer that you're currently looking at, then if you do go ahead and quickly type in these expressions, you may not get this result. You may get something that's more reasonable. So your computer here, it may use extended precision for intermediate calculations. So you may get a result that's closer to a half. It should, of course, be smaller than a half here. The point in looking at this is you don't know, and there's absolutely no guarantee. So if you have expressions like this, you're always going to be better off eliminating them. So the solution to this one is that you can just pull out your math table and then see that I can write cosine of x here as 1 minus sine squared with a 2 in front of it, and then x over 2. So if I plug that in, then actually 1 minus cosine of x over x squared here, it just becomes equal to a half here, and then sine of x over 2 over x over 2 squared. And in that case, the subtractive error is gone, and we're in business. So I see no reason why you'll happen precisely on this expression, but believe me, you will be evaluating some expressions that will involve trigonometric functions. And if you look at them, there are tons and tons of these expressions here, and often that'll allow you simply in a line or two to rewrite whatever it is that you're looking at, so you avoid these problems. And believe me, probably precisely the point where you want to evaluate this expression is when x goes to 0. So let me now give you, so let's call this, what was this, example 3? So let's look at example 4 here. And this one you'll actually be doing for the tutorial 4. So I want to look at summations. So I want to evaluate the sum here from k equal 1 to infinity of 1 over k squared. I know, by the way, that
one solve the problematic embedding by a very small number, because if you have a small error, precision error on the computer, like in the denominator, it's a huge
effect. If you say that again?
If you are dividing by a very small number, if you have an error, or a small error on the precision of the computer, you'll have a huge error.
That would quite often be a problem, right? You can,
but it's like some of the high board.
Well, so on the a number of these cases that I showed you, you can do rewrite them, so you don't get these huge errors. But you're right that you cannot do, unless, as I said at the beginning, that you can convert anything to integers, then you're going to have to live with these Markov errors. And you're going to have to be clever to make sure. I just showed you some examples where whatever was coming out of your program was off by, well, so the 1 minus cosine of x, it was off by what? 20% or something like this. Which was disastrous, and probably you would never have noticed. Unless you had actually proven that it was less than a half. So you have to be careful. But if you're worried at this point, then that's good. So this sum here, it's going to be pi squared over 6, and this here is 1.69449304.06. Okay. So I tried this on my laptop. So if we evaluate the first 4,096 terms here, I get, and this was using, so you have a Fortran compiler, which I believe is GFortran. The one I used was a previous Linux one, which was on my system called F77 here. Then I get 1.64472432. And you can see that the, oh, sorry, there's no 9 there. It's 1.6449. You can see that the error here is on the third decimal place. And then additional terms here, it does not improve on this. So can anybody tell me what went wrong here? After all, this should be... So what I did here was just... I did a do Kaggle 1 to 4,096. And then I said sum equal to sum plus 1 over 0, and then k times k. I would encourage you to try this, and you can see what you get. What's going to be the problem when I write something like this? Precisely, right? So if I go in here, then I already, so I wrote out this number here because I know that the eventual sum here, it's going to be an order 1. So I'm taking something in order 1, and then I'm adding something to it. So if my real here was declared just using 32 bits, then when this one here is smaller than epsilon, then I'm just precisely doing 1 equal to 1 plus epsilon equal to 1. In other words, any additional terms, I could run this loop up to
140,096, and I would claim here that the output would just remain a constant. So I can, one can make a plot here where you you look at the sum here, and then minus pi squared over 6, and then as a function of, let's say, big N, where we're iterating up to big N, which is a 44,096. If I actually do this on a log-log plot, then you'll see that the error will be going down, and then at some point it'll just do like this. Because you're just running around in circles and wasting your time. From the start, you could have said that, said to yourself that going beyond that point would be meaningless. Last year, when we did this course, it was done using the Intel compiler, and the Intel compiler actually boosted things in intermediate precision, so you could. It would not conk out here at 4,096, but would continue on for a bit longer. You should check what it does with your G Fortran compiler. So what should I do here? This is a very, I can fix this in a one line change to this code, yeah. What?
Well, the it depends on, when you do these floating point operations, a lot of stuff is obviously going on behind your back, because it has to actually do the additions, and it has to do the summations using some of the hardware. And if you have a compiler that knows quite a bit about how the registers and the CPU and how the cache is laid out, then it's possible to do this in a clever way. And typically, when a floating point is sent off to the units that will be doing the calculation, then intermediate results are actually kept in a precision which is beyond the final result. That's why you can do efficient roundoffs and so forth. And that means that if you're clever about it, then the people who write the compiler, then they can exploit this fact and avoid quite a few of the roundoff errors that you would be getting otherwise. So roughly, a good compiler that was built for the specific hardware that you had at hand will likely do better than a general purpose GNU compiler, which is targeted to a whole slew of CPUs, because they can't exploit the knowledge of the underlying architecture. So it's possible that the floating point units and some of the registers would be not using 32 bits, but maybe 128 bits or 80 bits, which is also typical. And then it's only when it goes back and stored in memory that it's truncated down to the 32 bits. But you don't, unless you really like to read technical manuals from the CPU manufacturers, then you wouldn't really know about this. How should we solve this problem?
Check the
Sorry?
Instead of starting from 1, start from
4. Yes. Right? So you see, you heard. Thank you for saying that. All I'm claiming here is that I can start with n, go down to 1, in a stride of minus 1, right? Because when I do this, then 1 over k star here, it may still be a very small number, but I'm not adding it to a number that's of order 1. I'm adding it to something that will be of the same order. So if I switch this one around, then I simply eliminated this. So you'll be summing a few series for the tutorial afternoon, and believe me, they have the specific quality of being rather nasty to evaluate. But they're very simple just to type in.
And if you look at the error here, and, well, if you might observe something like this, then it's a clear indication that you can improve on this by doing it in reverse order. The other thing is that you might see this, and depending on the convergence of your series here, it may be that you want to do this on a log-log plot, right? So maybe this is a log and then a log here. You may see the error decreasing, but then the error might be doing something like this. And if you see something like this, then this is likely not a feature of the underlying mathematical structure. It's a clear signal that whatever you wrote for the code here, it started to get contaminated by round-off errors. Personally, I would say that there's no reason to trust results beyond this point here. And often people, they say, oh, well, you know, I can go out and then I can look at some number here, and then they interpret that in some deep way. And I would always encourage you to, if you can, try to control the error on what you're doing. So I kind of like this because it's trivial. I just sum the opposite way, and things work out. Okay. So let me show you a few other things here. I can't remember. This is example 5. Yeah, I guess it is. So I have something where I have a function that is a and then cosine 3 of x plus b cosine squared of x plus c cosine of x here, and then plus d. And so that's my y variable. I want to set it equal to that. So I could implement this as y equal to a and then star and then maybe cosine of x here, star, star, 3. And then plus b star, and then cosine of x star, star, 2 here, and then plus c star, cosine of x, and then plus d. What would be wrong with doing that? Can anybody suggest a better way of writing a simple expression like this one? What? Yeah, okay, so if you don't know this, this is the Fortran way of doing a power. So the cosine of x to the power 3 here, that's written as star, star, 3. Well, so there's one problem here. Likely, unless the compiler is intelligent, which you can't bank on, then cosine of x here is actually evaluated 3 times, and that's likely very expensive. So instead of doing this, then you should perhaps say first that t here is cosine of x. A rule of thumb here, if you had a cosine of a constant, then maybe there's a better possibility that the compiler would have detected that it was the same expression for cosine that occurred and not evaluated cosine 3 times. So evaluating cosine here is, for practical purposes, slow. So if you just have an expression here where it's cosine of x, then you're better off setting t equal to, or evaluating cosine first. And then, well, let me show you how I would write this. I would write this as a here times t. Okay, so that would give us a times cosine of x here, and then plus b. Then I say a parenthesis around that, and then I multiply by t. Okay, and then I add c to it, and then I multiply that by t, and then I add d to it. I would claim that that would be equivalent. The idea, again, being that cosine of x here, it's not going to be bigger than 1. And it could actually be a rather small number. And when I start then taking it to a power of 3 and adding some other things to it, then I could again be adding large numbers to small numbers. And if I separate it out, so I do this sort of a telescopic way of calculating that same polynomial, then this here is likely always going to be the best way of writing it. So the I think for the tutorial this afternoon, you're going to be looking at a ratio of two factorials, and you sort of have the or two double factorials, and you have the same problem that occurs. So we talked about these other functions here that we can use. Okay, so let me just okay, the very very last example here.
We had this set of function at 2, right?
Yes.
So if we use a different algorithm using all the relations for the set of functions, like is it better is it converge?
you know, there are many different ways mathematically evaluating the theta function. That's true. My point was just that when you evaluate a sum, then in this case, it's one of the simplest cases that I know of to see that you're always going to be better off evaluating it bottom up. So you start from the small term and go in the other direction. I'm not saying that you couldn't evaluate the theta function more efficiently.
So let me do another example here, and that's the
have small powers instead to do a multiplication like we did, because it evaluates exponents using logarithms, and it'll fail if you have a negative number. Right. Is that true?
If you...
It's better to do a multiplication than like a small power?
So the trade-off, so I'm asking suppose I want to evaluate x squared, and so you're asking if I should write this as x dot x here, or x star star 2. Is that what you're asking?
Well,
In general, you're right. You should, well, actually, I believe that these are going to be equivalent. But what you should never do is you should never put a... in some cases, so it's again one of these things that in some cases you might actually have cases where you would write this as 2.1, and then you're taking x to a power here where that power is real when all you're trying to do is square it. So I believe that in most cases this here would be equivalent, but it's not going to be equivalent if you put just a period there. So never do that unless you actually have to, because then you're going to go in and it's going to be doing logs and things like that.
But what I, now I lost the eraser here. Where did the, what did I do with the, oh yeah, there it is. The, okay, so let's just do e to the minus x, right? So that, well, this here is 1 and then minus x over 1 factorial and then plus x squared over 2 factorial and then minus x3 over 3 factorial and x4 over 4 factorial. What is the radius of convergence for this Taylor series? It's one of the first things you learn in calculus, or maybe you didn't. What? Yeah, it's infinite, right? The right? So the radius of convergence here is infinite. This will converge anywhere in the on the real axis, right? So if I look at this and then I say that x here is equal to 10, okay, then x4 here over 10 over 4 factorial, this is actually 416.6. And even worse, if I look at x10 here over 10 factorial, then this is 3,100. You can probably guess here that the end result of this series here, that's going to be very close to zero here. So this is a prime example of an expression that I can mathematically prove will converge. But for practical purposes, this is not going to be very useful because I'll have big problems. And you can see this 416, if I'm adding it to it, then I could maybe arrange things or hope that these two would cancel, these two would cancel, but then I'm stuck with this one, which would be 416, and then that would have to be canceled by subsequent terms. So it looks like a miracle that this is going to work out. How would I actually do this? In this case, one can just evaluate e of x and then e to the minus x is 1 over e of x. And then things would be a lot better. But this is just an example of a very well-known series that one should be careful about plugging in. Another very famous example is the Taylor series for the inverse tangent, which has absolutely horrible convergence, and you can't really use that for anything. Okay, so one can play around with these things for a long time, and we're not going to continue with this. I just want to. My goal in telling you about this is just that you should be worried about these roundoff errors. And basically, if you just think a little bit about what you're doing, then likely it should be possible for you to improve significantly of whatever you wrote for the actual code. So before we well, actually, yeah, okay, so the I want to say a couple of words about the homework on the Bessel functions that you're supposed to be handing in, just because I'll need that later on. So let's talk a little bit about these Bessel functions. We have Bessel's equation. And it's set, and then dd set here of set, and then well, dr d set here, and then plus set squared minus p squared r, and that's equal to 0. And r here is actually comes out of the radial part of something. So the first thing here, when I solved this equation, and you might have done the same thing, I used Frobenius' method, where we assume here that R, it can be written as some kind of power series, and then you can go in, and then you can match coefficients, and you can figure out what that power series should be. So they're numbered here by P, and often you use the notation here that they're jp of x. And so it's a sum here over some power series. So I'm going to have to end here with an x over 2, it turns out, and then 2n plus p. And then before this, I have a minus 1 to the power n, and then a gamma of n plus 1. And then a gamma of n plus p plus 1. Now, what you would need would maybe be these Bessel functions for, say, order 50 or so, and downwards or upwards. Is this here going to be a good expression to use if you're actually, if you want to be able to access the Bessel function of a given argument at that order? So from what we looked at in terms of evaluating series and sort of writing expressions, is this here going to be good? Can you see a problem with it? What? Well, you would hope it wouldn't, because it should give us the Bessel functions. So this is actually, if you go out and grab Gradstein and Risney, then I believe that this is the expression that you'll find in there. Suppose here that I want to get the Bessel function to order 50, and that was actually for calculation that I was doing for a graduate student, I had to use that. You would be starting this series by taking x and then dividing by 2 and then evaluating that to the power 50. And that would be your first part in the sum, and then you would continue, then this here's trouble. The thing is alternating, so, well, we could have fun analyzing this, but there's a good chance it's going to end up looking like this, right? Then worse here is I have some things here that are basically factorials. It's a gamma function. So I have some big factorials that I have to evaluate when I get up to high order. And then I'm multiplying it by x to some gigantic power. This is just trouble. I was never able to use this expression for anything practical. So for the homework, if you've done it already, or otherwise, you may remember that when I look at the Bessel function, then if I look here at J0 of x, then it'll do something like this, and then it'll oscillate. If I look at subsequent Bessel functions, then it's actually only J0 that's non-zero when x is equal to 0. So if we look in the region here, where x is around 0.5, you know that this series actually would have to sum up if you're calculating or using it to calculate what J1 and J2 would be. Then you know already that your end result is likely going to come out to be very close to 0. You may be starting off with some relatively high powers, and it doesn't look like it's a good way to go. Now, then for the homework here, what you do is that you look at this, and then you can say that once I have a differential equation, then there is a one-to-one correspondence with a recursion relation. And so whenever you have a differential equation like this, you can always show that the solutions will satisfy a recursion relation. And if you have the recursion relation, you can actually figure out what was the differential equation. But we're not going to be particularly interested in that. So the one that you can use here is that you look at J1 plus Jn plus 1 of x here. And this is equal to 2 over n, 2n over x, and then jn of x. And then we subtract off jn minus 1 of x. So if you've done the homework already, you could say, oh, I don't want to do this big mess here. Is instead I want to do I assume some values for J0 of 0.1 and then J1 of 0.5 here. Okay, so then I could use this here to iterate upwards, and then something will happen when you do this. So I can use this to get J2 of 0.5, J3 of 0.5, and so forth. Now, if you've done the homework, then you'll realize that this doesn't work. Even though it sounds like a very clever way, and the homework will tell you a way to get around this, which is basically inverting what we did here and then obtain Jn minus 1 from a knowledge of Jn and Jn plus 1. But so there's one subtlety here, What do you think actually happens when you do this and you're iterating this way? How many of you guys done the homework? Or, okay, have you already handed it in? This is right on. So what was your answer, or what happened when you did this part here?
The numbers. Got a really good negative.
Yeah, it actually. Yeah, it just. Well, it decreases a little bit when you do it a couple of times, and then it diverges exponentially. What do you think it means when it diverges exponentially? Anybody who is thinking about that? So, the reason why I'm telling you about this is that how many equations or how many solutions is there to Bessel's equation? Two. What is the name of the other one?
It's not Neumann or von Neumann or something like that.
Yeah. So it probably has a name. What happened to the other one? Yeah, well, what happened to it is that we, so what you're saying is right, that we neglected that because for whatever purpose we were looking at, we argued that that solution was unphysical, and usually that would mean that it doesn't satisfy our boundary conditions. So if it has nasty divergences, then we just throw it out. So here's my point. Nobody told the computer about this. And what I just showed you here is that this equation is in a one-to-one correspondence with this recursion relation. So both the differential equation and the recursion relation is going to be good for both of these solutions to the to Bessel's equation. So nothing per se, well, there might be round-off errors and things like this going on, but the problem that you were looking at is actually slightly more subtle, because you have an undesirable solution to the equation that you want to get rid of. So if we're doing this, then we pick up the wrong solution. And so if you think of this in some abstract space, then I started out with the Bessel functions. That would be one solution that we'd be looking for, and then I'm iterating it, and everything is fine. But in doing that, I had a small round-off error, and that would mean that there's going to be some overlap with the undesired solution, and this will come in and contaminate things, and eventually that wrong solution, if you like, it's just going to grow and grow. But per se, there's nothing wrong with this recursion relation. The solution, of course, to this problem is that we can iterate the other way. So we're going to see a number of other places where this will happen, where you in principle have a mathematically exact solution here that's just for practical purposes is not of any great use. And then you get clever here and you then model it with some recursion relation. And in doing that, you're going to be struggling with the fact that there's going to be two solutions that you're susceptible to, the one that you would like to pick up, and then the one that we want to get rid of.
basically, yeah, so iterate here the other way. Okay, so, and the reason why this here, why this went wrong is that we have two solutions. Okay, so I think I'll stop here because otherwise I'm going to start talking about something completely different. So you're going to, for the next homework, you will solve a differential equation that's the Schrodinger equation. And this problem that you have two solutions, it's going to come in and haunt us again. And hopefully you should be able to get around to that. You want to?
So there's this one correspondence between recursion relations and differential equations.
Yes.
So
you can, if you want to have fun, then use this recursion relation and derive this equation.
Maybe later. but so is this, I guess, to iterate down, you use the fact that the next Bessel function is eventually much smaller than the one you're concerned with, right? Is that also true in general for a differential equation? Like, is this a, the trick we're using? Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so this, in what way this is going to go wrong will depend on where you're looking here, mm-hmm. and then, of course, also the Bessel equation. Or the equation, so the underlying differential equation. It's possible that iterating upwards would work, but iterating downwards would.
Okay.
And you just have to think about it.
Right. So every this isn't a nice little recipe for calculating the values of the solution to your differential equation that you've got.
In this case, it is. Right.
Well, yeah, it works here, but let's say I had a different differential equation.
A different differential equation, it might be the exact opposite way around.
Right. You sometimes neither one works, and sometimes.
Here the idea is that if one of them is catastrophic, then turning it upside down would make it very good.
Okay.
So that's roughly the idea. So you can. And of course. Again, what I was trying to say here is that if you could do all this to infinite precision, then actually you wouldn't have a problem, but you we have to do this in a finite precision, and that's why things go up. Okay, I'll stop here today and then